Well, good evening, everybody. And for anybody that doesn't think that the Lord of the Rings and the Rings of Power are part of the Bible, there you have it, at our features. If that's lost on you, don't worry about it. We are in episode 3 of our 7-part mini-series looking at the book of Esther. We considered in week 1, power. In week 2, coincidences. And tonight, in week 3, we consider hatred. Not only has the story of Esther taught us that life is painful, it has also taught us that life is unfair. Not only is life painful and unfair, but we also see that the righteous go unrewarded. In the beginning of our reading tonight, Haman... Now, for those of you who are wondering, that was planned, and we're good Anglicans, and so we're congregational in that way. You ready? All right. The book of Esther is one of the 5 festal garments. The 5 festal garments are 5 books of the Old Testament that the people of Israel, the Jews, read at their 5 festivals. And the book of Esther is read at the festival of Purim. And that will probably be the last time unless I ask her to do it once more. Every time Haman's name is mentioned, the kids and the adults boo and hiss and rattle and shake. And that gets really, really wild really, really quickly because Haman's name gets mentioned a lot. That was unscripted. We saw last week as Mordecai's story comes to the fore that he rescues the evil King Xerxes, the king that holds Mordecai's people in captivity. And you'd think that his righteousness would be rewarded as he saves the king's life. But then we pick up in chapter 3 that Mordecai is nowhere to be found, and this other guy, Haman, who we've not heard of before, has been elevated to the 2nd most powerful position in all of the kingdom. So we've learned. Life is unfair. It is painful. The righteous go unrewarded, and this evening we'll see that not only do they go unrewarded, but they suffer. Now, for those of us who are followers of Jesus Christ, this actually should not come as a surprise. Jesus said in John 15, "If the world hates you, keep in mind that it hated me first. If you belong to the world, it would love you as its own. As it is, you do not belong to the world, but I have chosen you out of the world. That is why the world hates you. Remember what I told you, a servant is not greater than his master. If they persecuted me, they will persecute you also." And so we keep that in mind as we come to this chapter in the book of Esther. The story really hinges at this point. Esther 1 and 2 has really just been an introduction, and now we meet Haman. We meet the real crisis of the story. And I've got 2 points this evening, again, maybe 3. 2 points this evening, and we're going to dive straight into the first one, and here it is. Hatred towards God has always been enacted against his people. Point number 1, hatred towards God has always been enacted against his people. Think back to the story of the Garden of Eden. Think back to the serpent that comes slithering in to deceive. He doesn't attack God outright, does he? He attacks God's people, Adam and Eve. Think of the story of the Exodus, where God's people are enslaved. They are persecuted. They suffer. Hatred against God. Pharaoh says, "Who is this God?" Hatred towards God is always enacted against his people. You think all the way through to Jesus Christ. Hatred towards God is enacted as sinful men hang Jesus upon the cross to crucify him and bring him about his death. And so in Esther chapter 3, we meet our 4th and final major character in the book, and his name is Haman. And his hatred towards God is enacted against the people of God. We don't know why he was promoted to number 2 in all the kingdom. it definitely comes as somewhat of a shock to us as readers, because we do think that Mordecai probably deserves that position. But no, King Xerxes gives no second thought to him. Basically, it's back to your desk at the DMV, Mordecai. And the king actually, we're told, gives a command. Verse 2, all the king's servants who were at the king's gate bowed down and paid homage to Haman, for the king had so commanded concerning that. Perhaps that's a little bit of a hint, that Haman has this really high position, but the king has to say, okay, you all need to bow down to him. But for whatever reason, verse 3, the king's servant, that Mordecai, verse 2, end of verse 2, Mordecai did not bow down or pay homage. And we don't really know why Mordecai makes this decision at this point. We've seen in chapters 1 and 2 that he is a bit of a compromised character. He told Esther to hide his Jewishness. He stayed in Susa in Persia when all of, not all, but a lot of the Israelites were called to go back to the city of Jerusalem. His compromised character at this point seems to melt away, and Mordecai makes his stand. The text does give us a few clues as to why this might be, but they're all by implication. The author or the narrator never comes out directly and says this is why. When we're introduced to Haman, we're told that he is the Agagite, or he is the Agagite. He is the son of Hammedatha, and he had been advancing in his upward mobility to this number two position. Now, Haman the Agagite, anybody want to take a stab at that? You don't have to tonight, I did the work for you. Here's a summary of Haman the Agagite. Generations earlier, the Israelites had secured a victory against the Amalekites. This was on their exodus from Egypt. This is back in Exodus chapter 17. And the Israelites defeat the Amalekites. And this is that story where Moses' hands are lifted to heaven, and he actually has to have people come and prop his hands up so that the Israelites can defeat the Amalekites. And at that point, following the battle, God made his people, the Israelites, a promise that he would wipe out the Amalekites, but that their sin had not reached its fulfillment yet. God reminded the nation of Israel later on in Deuteronomy chapter 25 that the Amalekites would be blotted out from under heaven. That inevitable confrontation finally reaches its fulfillment during the time of Israel's first king, King Saul. And we're told that actually Saul was an ancestor of Mordecai. Mordecai was from the tribe of Benjamin, and so it seems that Mordecai is actually a descendant of Saul. And God commanded Saul to totally destroy the Amalekites. That's what God said. But Saul, for whatever reason, spared Agag, the Amalekite king, and brought back not only the king, but some of the spoils of war. In deep ironic fashion, which is only true of the Bible because the Lord is at work, it would actually be an Amalekite that would kill Saul. At the heart of the book of Esther lies this conflict. That's the best thing that we're able to deduce. And it's not a conflict per se between Mordecai and Haman. It's a conflict between God and those who are his enemies. When Haman speaks, he talks of a certain people that are dispersed and scattered among the peoples of the empires. He identifies and basically sets aflame this entire community simply because Mordecai would not bow the knee. He says of this community, these Jews, they're different. Their law in particular is different from ours. It arouses our suspicion. It brings about a certain amount of resentment, and so they should be wiped out. Finally, in our introduction to Haman, because that's really what chapter 3 is, an introduction to Haman, we are told in verse 10 of this Haman, the enemy of the Jews. So here you have Mordecai the Jew. That's what the text says. Chapter 2, again, chapter 3, Mordecai the Jew. In actual fact, the people, the king's servants who were at the gate, verse 3, they said to Mordecai, "Why do you transgress the king's commands?" And when they spoke to him day after day, he would not listen to them. So they told Haman in order to see whether Mordecai's words would stand, for he had told them that he was a Jew. Somehow, in all of this exchange, the thing that Mordecai told his fellow workers at the DMV was that he was a Jew. He was of Jewish descent. Now, we need to remember, Jews, in the Old Testament, it's not an ethnic marker, it's a covenant marker. This story is rooted in Jewish history. It's not rooted in Jewish ethnicity. This is the revelation of the whole story of the Bible as it takes place. And so it's not so much that Haman said that I am an ethnic Jew, so much as he probably told his co-workers that this is the story of the covenant God of Israel. It's quite possible, text doesn't say it, so I'm speculating, but it's quite possible that he declared the wonderful deeds of the Lord, his saving power, the story of the Exodus, to his fellow workers at the king's gate. And when we read about the covenant people of God in verse 5, the author is reminding us of the whole sweep of events that has taken place. And so this is the conflict that's been at play. This is the conflict that's at play here. This is the conflict that has been at play since the great deliverance of the Exodus. The enemies of the people of God showing hostility towards the people of God. We read things like this throughout the Psalms. Why do the nations rage and the people plot in vain? And so Haman does what any narcissistic, evil, maniacal villain would do. He went to the king and he got permission to destroy all of the Jews. I know some people say that all that is needed for evil to triumph is for good men and women to do nothing. But here we see that all that is needed for evil to triumph is a weak and manipulated emperor and one evil man who has been slighted by another man. You notice it's not enough for Haman, who probably would have been completely in his rights, to have just offed Mordecai in some back alley somewhere. Look at verse 6, "But he disdained to lay hands on Mordecai alone. So as they had made known to him the people of Mordecai, Haman sought," verse 6, "to destroy all the Jews, the people of Mordecai, throughout the whole kingdom of Ahasuerus." Verses 12 to 15, Haman pulls the strings that he needs to pull. He basically goes to the king and says, there's this people, and they're a little bit sinister, and you probably don't really want them. Oh, and by the way, there's a lot of money behind all of this. And so the king basically makes a decision based on economics, and making a decision based on economics is never probably the wisest decision or the best decision. And so in verses 12 to 15, the edict is issued to destroy, to kill, to annihilate all the Jews, young and old, throughout the empire. This would have included the Jews everywhere, not just the Jews in the city of Susa, not just the Jews in Persia, even the Jews who had returned to Jerusalem and to the Promised Land. In actual fact, if Haman got his way, all of David's descendants would be wiped out, and there would be no Messiah to come. Such is the hatred and the anger that spills out of Haman to seek to destroy Mordecai. In fact, his hostility is so passionate that it actually blinds him ultimately to his destruction, but those are in future episodes. What I want you to see here, firstly tonight, is that God's enemies, that a hatred towards God always is enacted out against the people of God. But the second thing that I want you to see tonight as we work through the passage is that God remains faithful even when his people are faithless. I need you to go back a couple of thousand years and try to imagine that you were the intended audience for this letter, the original intended audience. The question that would have been on the mind of the Jewish readers of this book would have been, could they expect God to be faithful? Could they expect God to remember them? Could they expect God to keep his covenant promises when they had failed to keep theirs? The question that I think would have been on the forefront of their mind is the covenant still in effect, or will we be destroyed? Look with me at verse 12. Then the king's scribes were summoned on the 13th day of the month, and an edict according to all that Haman had commanded was written to the king's satraps and to the governors over all the provinces and to all the officials, to every province in its own script. This was a massive undertaking. 127 provinces. We have no idea how many official languages there were, but this was written out so that everybody could read it in their own language. It was written in the name of King Ahasuerus, and it was sealed with his signet ring, which incidentally he had given to Haman earlier on in chapter 3. And these letters were sent by couriers to all the king's provinces with the instruction to destroy, to kill, and to annihilate all the Jews, young and old, women and children, on one day. And so your reader at this point will be going, will God remain faithful even when we have been faithless? And without making a song and a dance of it, the answer is yes. In actual fact, we read in the New Testament, in Timothy, that this saying is trustworthy. If we have died with him, we will also live with him. If we endure with him, we will also reign with him. If we deny him, he will also deny us. If we are faithless, he remains faithful, for he cannot deny himself. You see, the rest of the story of the book of Esther is not about Esther or Mordecai or Xerxes or Haman. It's about God showing and demonstrating that even though his people had been faithless, even though they had been carried off into captivity, even though they were in exile, even though they had failed to keep their end of the covenant, even though they had disobeyed his laws, even though they had failed to listen to his word and to his prophets, he cannot deny himself. He has promised, and he will do it. And that's the teaser for coming back next week and the week after and the week after. I want to make a couple of applications, though, as we bring this story to a close. We've been reminded over and over in Esther already that nothing is ever coincidental. Even if the lot, and you might have noticed that, they were casting lots. They were literally rolling dice to decide the day that the people of God would be destroyed, even if the lot has been cast into the lap, even though it might seem that this is the will of the gods, nothing should ever deter us from trusting the one true God to deliver and rescue his people in order that he might keep and fulfill his ancient promises. Even though this situation seems as though it is impossible to overcome. Haman is the number two. Xerxes basically seems to have checked out. He says, here's my ring. You have all the power. Do whatever you want. The money sounds good. Nothing can ever get in the way of stopping God and his plans. And so the first thing that we need to understand by way of application this evening, and this is the most uncomfortable of all of it, God uses evil. It is not outside of his control. Now, I'm not saying that God is evil. I'm not saying that God causes evil. But I'm saying that even when evil people who hate God are hostile to his people, not even that can stop the Lord. You see that in the story of Joseph. What you intended for evil, God intended for good. You see that in the story of Jesus Christ, when he is handed over to wicked men according to God's set purposes. We need to see in this story that God is absolutely sovereign, even over hatred and evil and hostility. We need to see that God's sovereignty is displayed magnificently in the great paradox that even Satan's wrath and retribution working through worldly powers and worldly hatred and worldly emotions and worldly pride cannot stop God's eternal decrees. That God actually works at the same time that those forces are trying to work against him and his people. The second thing that we need to understand as we consider this passage is that this battle that's taking place between the forces of evil and God is a real battle. Ian Duguid writes of this passage, "The reason that this conflict is so often part of our earthly experience as Christians is that there is a hidden spiritual conflict that has been going on since the beginning of the world. Haman's enmity towards God's people was merely the latest manifestation of Satan's ongoing warfare against the people of God." And I think that that's really important for us to have in our minds from a theological point of view. Satan is not attacking God. Satan is cunning. He's not stupid. He knows that God is God. He knows that God is sovereign, and he actually knows that he can't defeat him. That's why hatred towards God always manifests itself in hostility towards God's people. And so we need to understand that we are part of a spiritual war that is taking place. Our expectation of life ought to be of a constant spiritual battle in which unseen spiritual adversaries are constantly attacking us. They are constantly against us. This is why Paul can write in Ephesians 6, "Put on the full armor of God so that you can take your stand against the devil's schemes. For our struggle is not against flesh and blood, but against the rulers, against the authorities, against the powers of this dark world, and against the spiritual forces of evil in the heavenly realm. Therefore, put on the full armor of God so that when the day of evil comes, you may be able to stand your ground, and after you have done everything, to stand." I think one of the things that we need to understand is that this spiritual warfare is personal warfare. Our battle is not against flesh and blood. I think one of the things that we can sometimes do with spiritual warfare is to sensationalize it and think that our battle is against flesh and blood. That our battle is against the people on the other side of the political lines that we might find ourselves falling on. We might think that our battle is against those people over there or those people over there. And yet it's fascinating because when Jesus speaks to this, what does he say? He says, if the Roman soldiers ask you to walk 1 mile, walk two. If they take your cloak, give them your tunic. He says to them, turn the other cheek. And so I think it's really important that we understand what it is that this spiritual warfare is. It's not against the media. The reality is that you're probably not facing physical, life-threatening persecution. But the way that we're persecuted might be something more along the lines of the cold shoulder at work, or being excluded from a particular friend group at university, or a curled-up sneer of the lip, or a line. Surely you don't believe that fairy tale nonsense in this day and age. We need to understand that at the heart of those reactions is really the, I wish that you weren't here. I wish you weren't part of this workplace. I wish that you didn't live in this neighborhood. I wish that you didn't compete in or participate in this club. Or some of us, we might even have family members who wish that we weren't part of their family. That life would, to put it bluntly, simply be better off without you. That's the kind of persecution that we face. It's that kind of hostility. Because people say in their hearts, there is no God. And we need to be clear about this because this is what we signed up for from the day that we chose to bear the name of Christ. We need to have our eyes wide open that as followers of Jesus, we can expect hostility. Now, I'm not saying to go looking for it, okay? I don't want anybody to come back here next week telling me that you went looking for hatred and hostility. But what I am telling you is that you shouldn't be surprised when it comes your way. And I shouldn't be surprised when it comes my way. I think the third point of application that I want to make this evening is really a lesson from the life of Haman about what happens when you show contempt. Many of you know that I spent 24 years in South Africa, and part of spending time in South Africa means that you read about and you learn about the history of the country, and of course, its first freely and fairly elected president, Nelson Mandela. One of the striking features of anything that he read, wrote, spoke, or that other people write about him is how much he fought against contempt, how much he fought against showing contempt. He knew that the power of hatred and what it did to people. He knew the power of hatred because he had felt it firsthand as he was locked up in a little island off the city of Cape Town, able to see the mainland, but never able to see his family for 27 years. He knew what it would have been like to show contempt to those who had persecuted him simply for the color of his skin. So what did he do? He worked day and night to root out those feelings of contempt and to replace them with love for all human beings. That was how he overcame that contempt. I wonder if you can see in Haman his contempt growing, his contempt for Mordecai that leads for contempt for the Jews, that leads for him to want to wipe out an entire people group through systematic genocide across the entire empire. Now, I doubt that there is one single person in this room tonight that is that maniacal and evil. And yet, who of us sitting in this room this evening don't struggle at some point or another with showing contempt for people? So there is a challenge here for us to learn what not to do as we look at the character of Mordecai, to fight those dark impulses that the world tells us are absolutely fine. That's how sinister contempt is. Contempt has become a commodity that is traded on the open market. It is fine and right and good, and you should feel contempt for people that are different than you, or hold different views for you than you, or who have a different religion than you, or you fill in the blank. It has become right and good, a character quality of the world, to show that contempt. And what Haman does ultimately becomes his undoing, but we'll look at that in the weeks ahead. Lastly, as we look at the character of Mordecai, I want us to see a reminder that it is never too late. As we sort of come full circle to Mordecai standing up, showing courage and boldness and steadfastness in his faith, it is never too late. For Mordecai, whatever reason, it came at this point. All right, the command wasn't to worship Haman. It was just to pay him respect and honor, to give him deference. Mordecai wasn't prepared to do that. He could have kept quiet. He'd compromised himself up to this point, but now he stands. And so perhaps from Mordecai, we learn that it's never too late for us to stand up, that it's never too late, regardless of what mistakes we may have made in the past, regardless of what guilt we might feel that we're carrying, because there was an opportunity to speak about Jesus or to make a stand for the gospel, and we sat down and kept quiet. It's never too late to stand up. Mordecai's sort of character arc over the course of the rest of the book really is serve the Lord, whatever the cost, because Mordecai worships him. You see, we need to be careful that we don't dwell on self-pity. We need to be careful that we don't get so caught up in a woe is me kind of way that we're going to suffer and be persecuted. This reminder that it's never too late is really a reminder that we are called every day of our lives to serve the Lord, whatever the cost. And we do that because the Bible tells us that it's normal. That's the normal Christian life. Remember, if they hated me, they're going to hate you too. So deny yourself, take up your cross, and follow me is what Jesus says. Jesus also tells us that it is a privilege to be able to follow in his footsteps. He says in Matthew chapter 5, "Blessed are you when people insult you, persecute you, and falsely say all kinds of evil against you because of me. Rejoice and be glad, because great is your reward in heaven." Also, as we think about it, we need to remember that our troubles, at best, are minor compared to the sufferings of many of our dear brothers and sisters in Christ. You can go look on the Open Doors website to read something of what our brothers and sisters in Christ face in North Korea or Eritrea or Iraq or Afghanistan or in Pakistan. In fact, a friend of mine at a church in London tells the story of a young girl from North Korea who came to Christ and came to Christ in London at their church, who told them of the chemical experimentation that North Korea does on pastors and Christians. She told the story of families having to watch, graphic something coming up right now, families having to watch their loved ones who profess Christ be lined up in a square, flat on their faces, to have a steamroller come and take their lives. Our troubles are light and momentary at best, but great is our reward in heaven. Mordecai is a reminder that it is never too late. It's never too late to go. It's never too late to respond to the call. It is never too late, as long as we call this life our life, to stand up. And so, perhaps I should ask you, what kind of opposition have you faced for following Christ? And that might be something that's well worthwhile thinking about and talking about after the service, because I doubt that any of us have faced sensational North Korean persecution. And yet, as a family, we can carry one another's burdens as we pray for and are mindful of what each other is going through. One more thing. The lot is cast into the lap, but its every decision is from the Lord. This is my third point. I said I had two and maybe three. Proverbs 16, verse 33 says, "The lot is cast into the lap, but its every decision is from the Lord." In verse 7 of chapter 3, we read that before Haman went to do anything, in the first month, which is the month of Nisan, in the 12th year of King Ahasuerus, they cast lots. They literally threw dice day after day and month after month until they finally worked out what day they should kill, slaughter, annihilate the Jews. And only once Haman had done this does he go to the king. And does he say to the king, "This is what you should do"? But here's this thing in the tale. We're told in verse 13, the day that this was to happen. It was on one day, the 13th day of the 12th month, which is the month of Adar. That means nothing to any of us. Until you work backwards and discover that that was the day before the Passover that year. This verse is a reminder of another great deliverance. Haman has masterminded this genocide, and yet coincidentally, the lot which was cast into the lap, its decision was from the Lord. In 11 months' time, on the day before Passover, the Jews would be annihilated forever. There was another event that took place at Passover a few hundred years later. A night where Jesus said, "This is my blood of the new covenant, not of bulls or goats." There was a night a few hundred years later where wine was also drunk, not by the emperor and Haman, but Jesus, saying, "This is my blood of the new covenant." On that night, it was not an entire people who were about to be annihilated, but just one man. But his death would be for the deliverance of the whole world and would bring many sons to glory. If you've never read this Bible, I encourage you to get it and read it, even as an adult. This is our family's Bible, and you can see it's been all over the world and is missing the back cover. In this story, one of Jesus' friends had made a bad plan. No one else knew what that bad plan was, but Jesus knew, and so did Judas. Judas was going to help the leaders capture Jesus for 30 pieces of silver. "Go on, Judas," Jesus said, and Judas got up from the meal and left the room and walked out into the night. Then Jesus picked up some bread and broke it, and he gave it to his friends. And he picked up a cup of wine and thanked God for it and poured it out and shared it. "My body is like this bread which will break. This cup of wine is like my blood, it will pour out. But this is how God will rescue the whole world. My life will break, and God's broken world will mend. My heart will tear apart, and your hearts will heal. Just as the Passover lamb died, so now I will die instead of you. My blood will wash away all your sins, and you'll be clean on the inside in your hearts." Esther foreshadows another deliverance on another night, a deliverance offered by a sacrifice that is once and for all time for the sins of the whole world. Yes, for my sins and for yours. And so I wonder if you will see tonight in the story of Esther that even though the lot is cast into the lap, that even though there are people in this world that hate God and are hostile to his people, God has fulfilled his promise. He has worked out his deliverance. Now, yes, that's a spoiler. You know how the story of Esther ends. But you're going to have to come back to see how it is that God does that. I'm going to ask Chip to come up, and he's going to lead us in a time of prayer and in responsive prayer in light of some of the things that were part of this message tonight.